The Ulster Economic Podcast. The podcast that keeps you up to date with what is happening economy-wise in Northern Ireland. Telling you what you need to know, but not necessarily what you want to hear. It is better to be prepared for the economic environment we are operating in and not the world we would like to be in. Episode 19. Hiking season returns. Time to head for the hill. We've become well used to price hikes with rampant inflation, but April was marked by tax hikes with the increase in national insurance contributions hitting the pockets of many employees as well as their employers. The attention now, though, is very firmly on interest rate hikes, with the Federal Reserve having just delivered its first half a percentage point rate increase in 22 years, with more to come as the Federal Reserve seeks to tame inflation, which is currently at a 40-year high. In the UK, the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee raised its bank rate to 1%, its fourth consecutive hike, a first in the 25 years since it was granted independence. As UK CPI inflation currently stands at 9%, also a 40-year high. Three members of the committee wanted to see the rates rise to 1.25%, and Governor Andrew Bailey made clear that these hikes won't prevent inflation from rising further, but he judged that they were needed to prevent it becoming entrenched. The European Central Bank, or ECB, also looks set to jump on the rate hiking bandwagon, having indicated that it'll start to raise some of its key interest rates in July. And we're seeing movement all around the world. Indeed, Australia recently increased its key rate for the first time since 2010. Russia is currently an outlier in the central bank world, having recently cut rates as the ruble rebounded from its initial Ukraine invasion slump. Last week, the Russian central bank cut its key interest rate to 11%, although it had been as high as 20% in late February. Turning back to the central bank rate hikers, many will cry, what the heck are they doing? As interest rate hikes bring even more pain to consumers who are already suffering from steep price rises and rising taxes. But as the Bank of England governor indicated, central banks need to do something. And the context is that the price of money is still incredibly low by historical standards. In the UK, more mortgages are now on fixed rate deals than during the last financial crisis, so people are less exposed to the rises than they may have been in the past. There's also an argument to be made that more pain now means less pain down the line, in the form of a prolonged period of higher rates of inflation. Indeed, central banks want to take the heat out of certain aspects of the economy, but there is a balance to be struck as people fear that rate rises could engineer a recession. Many are referring to what happened in the US in the 1980s. Then Paul Volcker, who was chair of the US Federal Reserve, and at 6'7", arguably the tallest central banker in history, cranked up the Fed funds rate to 20% in June 1981. That's where Russia's central bank jacked its interest rate to in February. Volcker saw this as the only way to stem rampant inflation. It worked, but it led to a significant recession and US unemployment rose above 10% as a result. The current chair of the Fed, Jerome Powell, is trying to do the opposite. Deal with inflation whilst engineering a soft landing as opposed to a hard landing which would involve a notable recession. History isn't on his side though. In the last 50 years, almost every time the Fed started a series of rate increases, it led to a recession. Elaborating on the aviation metaphor, some see Jerome Powell's challenge to replicate Captain Chelsea Sullenberger's Miracle on the Hudson. Back in 2009, Sully, as he was known, ditched US Airways Flight 1549 in the Hudson River following a bird strike and double engine failure. It was a successful landing and there were no casualties. However, whilst history isn't on Powell's side, some of the current economic indicators perhaps are. The labour market in the US is in rude health, and indeed some may say it is red hot with record levels of vacancies and unemployment very low. These characteristics are also applicable to the UK economy and many others. Earlier this month, financial markets had been penciling in several more rate hikes in the UK, topping out at 2.5%. If that was to occur, the Bank of England reckoned earlier this month that the UK economy would flirt with recession and would see a dip in output. Alternatively, if interest rates remained at 1%, UK CPI inflation would remain above the Bank of England's 2% target in 2 years' time. That implied that at least some more interest rate hikes over and above the 1% rate are required. But in many respects, the threat of recession should be secondary or even a tertiary concern given the scale of the cost of living crisis. Indeed, last week, Rishi Sunak was compelled into unveiling a significant package of measures amounting to $15 billion. Two-thirds of the support was aimed at the most vulnerable households. This intervention could avert a recession and will mean that the UK households will no longer face the steepest decline in real disposable incomes since records began in 1956. Nevertheless, the outlook remains grim, just not quite as grim as it was. Personally, I expect at least one more interest rate rise, possibly two, and Rishi Sunak may need to come back with more cost of living cash injections later in the year. More fiscal support, which reduces the downside risk to the economy, could mean that the Bank of England has more scope to raise interest rates even higher later on. Whether or not we see a recession remains to be seen, but the impact of the hike in interest rates and the expectation of more to follow has already had implications for financial markets in terms of equities and currencies. In relation to equities, the old investor adage is to sell in May and stay away until St. Ledger's Day, which is the horse race in September. But investors have been heading for the exit since the start of the year. The expectation and reality of interest rates are bad news for growth stocks. We're now in the most coordinated global interest rate hiking cycle in over 20 years. Global equity markets largely escaped when the pandemic took hold, bar some initial falls. Equity markets subsequently soared as central banks around the world pumped trillions into the system. And indeed, at one point in 2020, the Fed was effectively printing $1 million per second. Last year was dubbed the everything rally, from stock markets to cryptocurrencies and from property to secondhand cars. But most stock markets and cryptocurrencies are all down year to date, and Wall Street's S&P 500 index has had its worst start to a year since 1939. At one point, it was 20% below its record high in January, although it has recouped some of these losses in the last week of May. Meanwhile, the tech-heavy NASDAQ is already in a bear market and has already been down 30% from its peak last November. As of the end of May, it is down about 24%. The UK's FTSE 100 is one of a few stock markets to be in positive territory year to date, along with Brazil and Spain. Rising interest rates are basically calling time on this remarkable era of cheap money. When the cost of money was almost at zero, speculation was rife and investor appetite struggled to be satisfied. Aggressively raising interest rates, coupled with fears of a global recession, has popped that bubble. All of this has implications for everybody around the world through, for example, pension funds. Consumers going on holiday, particularly to North America, will also notice that there's been a big impact on exchange rates. Given that the Fed is expected to raise rates by more than the ECB and the Bank of England, the dollar has soared. Conversely, sterling has slumped. Last May, the sterling to dollar exchange rate hit a high of $1.42, whereas it has recently hit $1.21, although today is trading around $1.26. Interest rates may be back at where they were 13 years ago, but the currency isn't. The summer of 2009 saw sterling just shy of $1.70, but today £5,000 would yield $2,200 fewer dollars. Again, consumers are impacted by interest rate rises in the form of the price of petrol. Oil is priced in dollars but is purchased with sterling. So as the value of the pound goes down, all things being equal, the price of oil goes up from a currency perspective. As a result, on the 8th of March, the price of a barrel of Brent crude oil hit a record high of almost £98 per barrel. And as of the 30th of May, the corresponding figure is just under £95 per barrel. The appreciation of the dollar and rising interest rates are also bad news for many lower income countries around the world, Indeed, there's talk of an emerging debt crisis. Not only are countries in Africa and the Middle East impacted by soaring food and energy costs, the cost of the debt that they loaded up on over the past decade, when the price of borrowing was so low, has surged due to significant parts of this being priced in dollars and also linked to US interest rates. All of this means that there's an expectation that poverty rates globally will surge. Northern Ireland poverty rates will also surge given the cost of living crisis. Indeed, a couple of weeks back, the one economic think tank stated that 43,000 households in Northern Ireland will see their food and energy bills rise above their disposable incomes. Clearly, things are going to get worse and politicians need to get to grips with it sooner rather than later. There is around £435 million earmarked for Northern Ireland to distribute to households to ease the cost of living crisis burden. In this environment, it will become increasingly untenable for Northern Ireland's politicians to remain out of power and not to head for the hill. So looking at the incoming economic data and surveys for Northern Ireland in May and what's hot and what's not. Firstly, Northern Ireland's PMI survey. Private sector businesses saw their rate of activity slow from 56.3 in March to 54.8, still respectable enough growth rate, but the slower rate of growth was accompanied by higher rates of inflation. Northern Ireland firms raised the prices of their goods and services at a record pace in April, and manufacturers saw their input costs rise at a record rate. Looking at business activity by sector, manufacturing and services continued to grow strongly, but construction remains in decline, with construction orders falling for the 10th month running. Looking at overall supplier delivery times, also lengthened at their fastest pace in 5 months. Turning to the labour market, it's a case of almost like deja vu with the positive labour market statistics. Northern Ireland's ILO unemployment rate hit a joint record low of 2.3%. And it was another record high as far as the HMRC payrolls in April were concerned. While the labour market may be hot, new car sales certainly are not. And new car sales remain weak in April and they continue to be impacted by supply chain difficulties, particularly from the outbreak of the war in Ukraine. Just an update on my own electric car, which I've talked about in previous podcasts. The electric car was ordered last July, at the start of July. The latest I've heard is it's now not going to be this summer, but it's now going to be September. So I've got a charger, but I've got no car. Turning now to another positive development in some of the economic stats is on hotel occupancy rates. They're continuing to hot up. Hotel occupancy levels in March were 61%, which is marginally below the pre-pandemic level of 60% in the March 2019, while it remains below 2018's record high of 68%. However, given that there are actually more hotels and more capacity now than there were whenever the record high was achieved back in 2018, Northern Ireland has actually seen 5% more rooms sold in March of this year than back in 2018. March 22 was the best March on record for room sales, with just shy of 180,000. Turning then to the property market, residential property transactions are still holding up. Residential prices for the first quarter of this year were up 10.4% year on year, so no sign of a meaningful slowdown as yet. The only real area where we're seeing a slowdown is on house completions, which is actually the rate of house building of completed dwellings, where both in the fourth quarter of last year and the first quarter of this year were the lowest quarters for completed dwellings in 5 years. The property market was one of the beneficiaries from the Everything rally since the pandemic, and I suppose it is worth delving into the property market in more detail, and no better way to do that than to ask Jordan Buchanan, who's the chief economist for PropertyPal, to come and share his views and thoughts on where he sees the property market. I know we have seen in the likes of some of the areas, such as Canada and New Zealand, which have been raising interest rates, that they're now starting to see price declines. And I suppose the key question, which a lot of people ask in Northern Ireland, is then, if we've got this cost of living crisis and all interest rates are rising, what is going to happen with the residential property market in Northern Ireland? So, first of all, delighted that you could join us, Jordan. And what are your general thoughts and where are we?
Hi, Richard. Yes, thanks very much for the introduction, and delighted to be here tonight and chat with you about the housing market. So, yeah, it's been a roller coaster couple of years in the market, clearly. I mean, whenever we first went into COVID, like everything, we were facing the biggest kind of economic recession in 300 odd years. And everyone with a rational mind said, well, clearly the housing market is not going to be immune from this and is going to experience a lot of downward pressure. Thus far, that really hasn't happened. And as you touched on there, I mean, advanced economies right across the world, whether it's in European markets, Australasian markets, into the UK or into North America, they've all done exceptionally well. Now we're kind of at this kind of inflection point where the economic evidence, again, has turned quite gloomy. There's the cost of living pressures, and everyone's kind of come back to, well, surely if anything is going to stop housing markets' robust performance, it's going to be this. So, we're collectively trying to understand that. And in the short term, there doesn't look to be any slowdown yet. I mean, all the data and kind of the economic signals that we're tracking are still suggesting there's lots of interest and lots of appetite for housing. Sales numbers look healthy. Price growth is, to be honest, it's still too high, and a wee bit of downward pressure would be for the betterment of the market. But at the minute, things are still looking exceptionally strong. It's whether or not that lasts for 3 months, 6 months, or another couple of years.
And in terms of the price growth, is there any sort of differences in terms of the market? Is what areas are seeing different rates of price growth?
Yeah, there absolutely is. I mean, I'm sure you've heard, and a lot of your listeners have heard, the term the race for space has been coined a lot over the last couple of years, which very simply has mean there's been a premium put on space and properties. And like everything, you know, people were in their houses for longer, they were maybe working from home, they maybe had childcare at home. It really changed the priorities of what people were looking to get for out of their property. So we've seen this, the change in price for particularly larger homes, sort of your detached homes with maybe 4 or 5 bedrooms or additional functional space. They're growing at much faster rates than even, say, apartments or smaller kind of 2-bed terrace houses. So we've seen that shift in the market, but even into the sort of the property types, new build houses are commanding a significant premium at the minute relative to kind of our resale index. So just for the numbers on it, our resale index at the minute suggests price growth sitting at around sort of 5% year on year, new build market sitting at around sort of 17% year on year. And that's largely a reflection of some of the factors you touched on earlier, whereby supply chains and considerably higher input inflation to home builders is really eroding that margin. And given the market conditions are still very strong, they're largely passing through a lot of that cost to the end user, which does seem to be paying it at the minute.
Then I suppose the obvious concern is then in terms of building, when you've got, if you look at the current environment, there couldn't be a worse time for actually planning to build houses in terms of the uncertainty, the cost pressures. What we're likely to see is then just a further underbuilding by builders. That's going to have knock-on effects in supply. And, you know, are we going to see a pickup in supply anytime soon? Probably not.
Yeah, probably not, is the truth. On the new build side of things as well there, I mean, anyone who's considering doing a self-build, I mean, firstly, it's very difficult to get a fixed price contract now because the build pressures and the inflationary pressures are so variable at the minute. It's almost impossible to accurately kind of forecast what the expected cost is over a sort of 12-24 month period. But for even the bigger developers, I mean, operationally, it's never been a harder time to kind of forward plan, you know, because you don't know what's going to happen in kind of the Russia-Ukraine axis. You don't know how that's going to impact your ability to import a lot of your products. And steel prices at the minute, for example, are up sort of 55% year on year. Particle boards around 60%. Timber has settled a wee bit, but it's still far higher than what it was. And the important thing as well is, whilst we're kind of talking about inflationary pressures being so high, even if by kind of what we're all hoping for, this does subside in the next 6 to 12 months, it will only subside back to kind of more sustainable levels of growth. It does not mean we're suddenly going to have a long period of deflation where prices are going to revert back to what they were kind of pre-COVID levels. So that's very much the new cost base going forward, which everyone's kind of having to plan for on that level.
Yeah, and so this whole idea of the mismatch between supply and demand, the underbuilding, which we were doing before the pandemic, is likely to continue. And I suppose from households' perspective, if there's a shortage of houses for them to move into, if they're thinking about trying to extend their houses, the problem is they're faced with the high costs of that as well. I suppose just turning to affordability, and clearly the affordability challenges are going to hit the housing market and offer another headwind to it. I suppose from a lender's perspective, what we're likely to see is we've already seen rises in some of the interest rates, which you maybe want to talk about. But what we'd expect to see is lenders then, they would be then introducing a lot of these increased energy and food costs into their affordability calculations. And also they would probably look at then how they would change their maximum loan to value ratios, and that would be in a downward direction. So there's clearly headwinds on that side. And just what are your thoughts on affordability?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, lenders play a really critical role in how housing markets function. I mean, you know, cash buyers only represent really around 25-ish% of the market in a normal year. So essentially, you know, 3/4 of market activity is driven by, in some aspect, by mortgage lending. So with the cost of living pressures and inflation and the potential likelihood for interest rate rises, ultimately it's going to mean mortgage rates are going to get more expensive. And we've already started to see that. We're looking kind of at global economies to see how their markets are responding in response to rising rates. So, I mean, it's very simple. You know, if your debt servicing costs increase, you're going to have a smaller pool of buyers of how much they can afford, but also potentially a smaller pool of buyers full stop. And that in itself will limit the extent of which where we'll see further house price growth as people have to start paying more towards servicing the cost of a mortgage. So it will cool demand undoubtedly. But I guess we're still, you know, in my head, it's a wee bit overplayed at the minute because interest rates are still at 1%. You know, mortgage rates in the UK are kind of, obviously depending on your loan-to-value ratio, you're getting it somewhere between kind of low 2.2 to maybe 3% range at the top side. So it's still really competitive rates for mortgage lending. It's the extent to which that will maybe go to sort of 4 or 5%, depending on the path of interest rates, where we need to watch and see how that would really start to impact demand.
Yeah, and it's because the majority of mortgage owners now are locked in with fixed rate mortgages. So even if you were locked in for a 5-year rate, and even if that was expiring sort of in the coming month, it's the interest rate rise is probably only about 0.25 percentage point higher than what it was previously. But I suppose the interest rate rises are going to be, it's not an instantaneous impact, but it's going to be as more and more of those fixed rate mortgages roll off next year, the year after, and the year after that. Mortgage owners are going to find that the unlike what we've seen over the last 12 to 24 months, interest rates they're not going to be able to fix on a more favorable rate and lower mortgage payments. It's going to be going in the opposite direction.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, understanding interest rate moves is clearly very difficult. Markets notoriously struggle to forecast interest rates given the extent of kind of potential global exogenous shocks, which can really impact those decisions. But undoubtedly, the household sector is far less sensitive to changes in interest rates as it was, even if we think back to sort of 2007-08. You know, at that point in time, 45% or so of mortgages issued were self-certification and the vast majority were on adjustable rate mortgages. To date, you know, since around 2015, it's 90% of mortgages are on fixed rate. The Bank of England estimate the average shielding time, which is really the period between someone coming off their fixed rate mortgage and moving to the bank's sort of standard variable rate mortgage, is in and around 3 years, as people have increasingly looked to take longer fixed rates for that kind of financial security. So, no, it won't be an immediate impact for that pool of people who have a mortgage. It will obviously impact first-time buyers who are coming to the market, obviously without a mortgage, and those who maybe don't have that same length of shielding time present there. But it will be a more gradual impact. So any immediate change to interest rates will not have that direct impact feeding through. And interesting, if you look at across this kind of the UK-wide mortgage book at the minute, the total stock of adjustable rate mortgages is in around £300 billion worth of mortgage debt. The total stock of kind of short-term deposits in bank accounts is around £900 billion. So in kind of a weird way, you know, any immediate change to interest rates might actually be a help to consumers because they'll gain more in net terms through the savings channel than those who will lose through paying higher mortgage rates.
And then turning to, we often think in terms of the residential property market, homeowners, but of course a big segment are those people who rent, particularly the private rented sector. And what's been happening there in terms of supply and demand and private rented sector in Northern Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to talk about the rental market in a sense because it's almost so out of touch now with what reality should have been in pre-COVID terms. You know, rents at the minute, since COVID hit, and generally during periods of economic uncertainty, you start to see a rise in demand in the rental markets, and that did play true. Rents very quickly accelerated in around sort of 5.5-6% year on year, and they've stayed there for the large of the last 2 years. So parts of, say Ards and North Down, for example, one of the more affluent areas of the market, you're broadly speaking, you're now paying for 11 months rent over a 12-month period, the other way around there, because the pressures have got so severe. It's almost up an additional sort of £100 over a year that you're paying towards servicing that cost of rent. And whenever you factor in there's been a real dearth or a shortage of stock coming to the market on the rental side for reasons I'm still truthfully trying to figure out. Part of it, we've seen a lot of landlords selling up, presumably availing of the strong selling conditions. But a shortage of rental properties come to the market against a really strong backdrop of heightened demand. On a standardised basis on the PropertyPal website at the minute, there's roughly speaking in and around 60 inquiries to go and view a rental property for everyone that comes on the market. Pre-COVID, it would have been in around sort of 15-ish inquiries. So it's well over three times the level of demand that was there in previous points in time. And it's created a really difficult market for tenants trying to find good quality and in any way affordable rental accommodation.
And I suppose that's a context where you're seeing the demand and the influx of build-to-rent schemes then sort of coming into Northern Ireland, clearly demand there. But I suppose one of the challenges, particularly for the rental sector, is going to be the rented sector arguably has some of the most energy inefficient houses around, and you just think of what lies in store with the whole energy price rises, the lack of insulation in a lot of these rental properties. Private rented sector is going to be at the front line, really, of the cost of living crisis in the coming months.
Yeah, absolutely. And last year, again, on PropertyPal, around half the rented properties advertised were below EPC level C. So it's kind of saying they're amongst the less well-insulated or sort of energy-efficient properties in the country. So as we move into kind of the colder months towards the autumn period, when kind of the Bank of England's consensus forecasts are that inflation will potentially be at its worst or it's peaking at that point, I think there's real concerns coming down the line for that segment of the rental market. And that will obviously have much wider economic and general housing market implications because, you know, there's a lot of small landlords across Northern Ireland who are very much reliant on that rental income to service the mortgage payment. And that's kind of the area where I'm trying to get a better idea and a better understanding of what the looming pressures are, because if we're to go into a position where we start to see tenants struggling financially to keep up with the rent, and that has a knock-on impact where the landlord maybe can't afford to pay the mortgage anymore, the impact that could have in terms of potentially leading into forced sales, you know, the landlord maybe having to think, right, well, this isn't a sustainable model anymore and they have to sell the house, it's going to clearly add significant pressure to the tenants in the property directly, but also to the wider housing market and the rental market with that exacerbation, if you will, of the ongoing shortage of properties.
And of course, some of the new environmental regulations which are going to come into play, currently they're in play in England in terms of rent. New lets are going to have to meet a minimum energy efficiency standard. I think it's C, is it?
Yeah, I believe it's C by 2027 and for existing tenancies by 2030.
Yeah, and so if something similar comes into Northern Ireland, again, you would maybe find for some landlords, they may want to exit the market because of that. So, which is maybe potentially good news for people who are wanting to get on the first rung of the property ladder. But then if that takes rental stock, further stock out of the market, and that seems to be the trend that we've been experiencing over the last number of years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, undoubtedly that change is coming. It's a matter of when. I mean, I'm not sure how it quite works at the minute without the sitting of the executive, you know, to move, because that's the second stage of the legislative bill, was around the energy efficiency. So that's the direction of movement in England and Scotland and Wales. So Northern Ireland will follow suit, and it's expected to follow a similar-ish path. So there's undoubtedly going to be a big change in the rental market, and it's going to create bigger questions around the investment in retrofitting those houses, which some of them are amongst the least energy efficient properties in the country. And that obviously comes with a huge cost. So the landlord is either going to have to absorb that, they're going to undoubtedly be looking for grants to support that. But it's likely going to lead through into higher rents as well. So some of that will be passed through to the tenants, who will have to pay more for the property. And the counter argument that says if we start to see more landlords selling up, that might create more properties available potentially for first time buyers. Well, yes, it absolutely does. But it also means they're sitting with a stock of poorly insulated properties as we move forward into an era where particularly lenders will be trying to prioritise improving their mortgage book towards the more energy efficient properties. And again, in time, I think you will see that value reflected in what people are willing to pay for the house directly, because it's still at its very early stages in that yet. And there's not a clear evidence base to say someone's willing to pay a lot more for an energy efficient property today. But I think that will change considerably in 3 to 4 years' time, where you will see that premium being commanded for the property.
Yeah, because clearly it's one thing forking out money for an energy efficient home if it's going to be your lifetime home. It's quite another thing if you're going to be reticent to shell out money for a property that you might only be in for 2 or 3 years. And that's going to be the challenge that policymakers are going to have to do.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, the payback period it can take a considerable long time. If you're investing sort of £10,000, and that maybe means you're saving 50, 60 quid a month or so on potential costs, that will take several years to get the benefit of that. But if suddenly that £10,000 investment is reflected in an additional £6,000 premium towards the value of the house as a result, then the payback period clearly falls quite considerably, and it makes it a more kind of lucrative prospect for people to perhaps make that behavioural change and think about that investment.
And Jordan, one question that everybody will want me to ask is, what's going to happen with Northern Ireland property prices this year?
I thought I was going to get away with it today. Look, in line with everything we've talked about, clearly there is so much uncertainty at the minute, and kind of the unknowns around the path for interest rates that, truthfully, it makes forecasting impossible to do in any sort of applied modelling work. It's very much reliant on assumptions you make. So assuming interest rates get to, say, sort of 2% even within the next sort of 12 months-ish, I still think you'll see pretty competitive mortgage lending, and if lenders are keen to keep their risk appetite there in the market, I truthfully can see the market continuing to relatively sustainably. I think you'll see a reduction in the transaction levels, and you'll see sort of a change in patterns towards the lower end of the market. But given the increase in household savings over the last couple of years, the command that people are still paying for the type of high demand properties with more space. Truthfully, I think on aggregate, you'll see price growth settle by the end of this year in around sort of 2-3% across Northern, which is obviously considerably lower than its current rate of around sort of 10%. So rather than seeing falling prices, I just think you'll see the rate of price growth slow considerably this year. I think most of those kind of cost of living pressures that we've talked about will really come to the markets kind of next year. I think that will be reflected in weaker transaction levels, and my forecast or my scenario or my assumption based on kind of what we've talked about, it's very difficult to see any growth in property prices throughout 2023. I think the real income falls will start to be reflected in market activity next year. So I think you'll see flat growth next year. The main indicator I'm trying to, as I mentioned earlier, I'm keeping a pulse on, is the level of forced sales coming to the market, people kind of having to sell the house because of perhaps default or repossession. At the minute, there's no clear evidence to say that's a concern, and actually household indebtedness and the financial sector looks pretty healthy. So I think it will just be a matter of consumers tightening their belt and maybe thinking, there's a lot of financial uncertainty. Maybe now isn't the best time to be thinking about doing that. So I just think you'll see it all slow a wee bit more reflected in the transaction numbers, but prices will largely stay stable-ish and negligible growth next year, if any at all.
Okay, thanks very much, Jordan, for that insight. That was Jordan Buchanan, Chief Economist with PropertyPal. And just interesting to note that one of the other property-related issues which was evident within the Queen's speech a couple of weeks ago was that councils in England are now able to introduce a effectively double the council tax charge, which is the equivalent of our rates here in Northern Ireland, for properties which are effectively second homes if they're not rented out. So if there was a Stormont executive up and running, that could be one of the issues that it would be grappling with in the coming months ahead. Looking to the month ahead in June, the hiking season as far as interest rates are concerned is set to continue. The Federal Reserve has signalled a 50 basis points or a half a percentage point increase in June, with the same in July. The Bank of England will decide on its monetary policy settings on the 16th of June. Following four successive months of rate hikes, we expect two further rate rises in June and August, so that will be 6 from 6. The Bank of England is then expected to tread more cautiously as recessionary risks continue to mount. Slower growth is going to be a theme, and a few months ago recessionary talk was quite niche, but now it is somewhat mainstream. Slower growth and a deterioration in business conditions is set to continue in the month ahead at a global UK and Northern Ireland level. Last week we saw Boris Johnson was boasting about UK unemployment at its lowest level since 1974, but UK consumer confidence has fallen to its lowest level since 1974 too. And before Rishi Sunak's recent intervention, real disposable household incomes were set to fall at their steepest pace since records began. We will increasingly see the cost of living crisis making its presence felt in the coming months. Indeed, given the slump in business activity, particularly within the services sector, which was highlighted in the UK's flash PMI for May, we can expect something similar in the Ulster Bank Northern Ireland PMI for May as well. Alongside, we're likely to see more record highs in input cost and output price inflation. The UK's red-hot labour market is likely to continue in the near term. The staff shortages coupled with the cost of living crisis have already seen employers look at in-year pay reviews and cost of living bonuses. But the public sector is increasingly going to be under pressure to deliver affordable pay demands. Realistically, you're looking at 2 to 3% at best. Although, while some public sector strike action from the likes of TransLink has been called off, there has been talk of potential industrial action within the PSNI. A summer, autumn and winter of discontent beckons as far as public sector strike action is concerned. Northern Ireland's protocol is a political hot potato once again. Rather than an oven-ready deal, it has resembled something dinged in a microwave. For some, notably Northern Ireland firms exporting to the Republic of Ireland, it has been a hot ticket to additional trade, but it has given rise to food poisoning for others. A UK-EU trade war needs to be avoided, and a soft landing with the protocol needs to be executed. Not least, as it is currently a block to establishing the Northern Ireland Assembly and Executive. The optimist within me thinks a political landing zone should be found, and we certainly don't want to see Liz Truss and Marius Sefcovic having to do a Sully and ditch the Northern Ireland Protocol in the Laggan. Previous podcasts have highlighted concerns over food prices and the impact of the war in Ukraine. Earlier this month, the front page of The Economist magazine was titled "The Coming Food Catastrophe," and Governor Andrew Bailey was sounding apocalyptic about food prices. Apocalypse is never a good word, particularly in the economy. This highlights the concerns for the world. Also, currently, only half of the expected food price increases have hit the supermarket shelves so far. And also a warning to that your local chippy could be under increasing pressure. Fish and chips are under severe inflationary pressure from the likes of Ukraine sunflower oil. And also in terms of sanctions, fresh fish sanctions, which will lead to additional tariffs on fish, which invariably comes from Russian waters. Clearly, our local chippies are likely to take a battering in the coming weeks and months. Clearly, the cost of living crisis is going to get worse before it gets better. This winter, the scale of the challenge will be more apparent with the cold weather. On that cheery note, and given that we've learned that the first case of monkeypox has arrived in Northern Ireland, I will end it there. Until next time, I am Richard Ramsay, and this was episode 19 of the Ulster Economics Podcast. The hiking season returns. Time to head to the hill. You can stay up to date by following us on social media and the UlsterEconomics.com blog.